Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome. I'm Lyndall Johnson, one of the Sims local Dharma leaders, and I'll be talking tonight, filling in for Rodney while he's out of town. And it's really nice to see a nice crowd of people out here. This is great. The subject of my talk tonight is faith, and I thought that would be an especially appropriate subject both for this wintry season and for this holiday season. And I'd like to start by kind of setting the wintry scene with a poem by Theodore Ruffke. I first intended to close our sitting with the poem, but then since we're timing with the clock and I didn't have the bell in front of me, I thought, so what happens if I start the poem and the bell goes off in the middle of the poem? That wouldn't be so good. So I decided I would wait. The poem is called It Was Beginning Winter by Theodore Ruffke. It was beginning winter, an in-between time, the landscape still partly brown. The bones of weeds kept swinging in the wind above the blue snow. It was beginning winter. The light moved slowly over the frozen field, over the dry seed crowns, the beautiful surviving bones swinging in the wind. Light traveled over the wide field, stayed. The weeds stopped swinging. The wind moved, not alone, through the clear air, in the stillness. I love that poem because it just expresses so beautifully this season we're in, this in-between time, with bones of weeds swinging in the wind. It's a season when there's growing darkness, increasing cold, which we really noticed these past few weeks, and when so much of the natural life around us is dying or going dormant or hibernating. And within us, a lot of times, we can also feel this sense of winding down. The winter is often a time when we feel kind of low in energy and we start to turn inward and feel like we want to hibernate too. For some, it's even a time of depression because there's so little light. All in all, it really isn't a season that offers us a lot of inspiration, especially here in Seattle once the clouds and the rain set in. It can be pretty gloomy. This time of winter doesn't offer the promise and the sense of awakening that we have in spring, not the long, warm, beautiful days we have in summer, or even the sense of fulfillment that we get with the harvest in autumn. It's kind of a difficult time. And yet, in spite of this, or you know, maybe really it even is because of this, winter is really very much also a season of faith. And it seems to be a kind of time when, with so little light provided from our surroundings, we really need to be, as the Buddha advised us, a light unto ourselves. And when we look at the various celebrations and traditions that people have at this time of year, we can kind of see how this happens in many cultures. At one of the more basic levels, we have the celebration of the solstice itself, a celebration of our faith in the return of the light. And at the time that we celebrate, really this change is still something it's really imperceptible. We can't really even see it yet. And yet we celebrate because we know that this change has come. And other celebrations too are dealing with light and faith. Hanukkah, for example, is a celebration of light and also a celebration of faith and the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem that happened after many years of rule of the Holy Land by the Greeks. And of course, the Christmas season most definitely is a celebration of faith and light. Faith that the tiny baby whose birthday we celebrate at this time really could be a light unto the world and bring a promise of peace and goodwill. So overall, it just really seemed like a good time to speak about faith. And as in these traditions I've mentioned, faith is also a very important part of Buddhism. Not so much the faith in a deity that we see in many religions, but still faith all the same. Faith in a process, faith in the truth of the way things are. And above all, faith in our own ability to see that truth and to release ourselves from suffering by really understanding that truth. And now in the Buddhist tradition, there are several different types of faith that are often discussed. And one of the first that's usually mentioned, and the first one that I'll mention, is blind faith. And now blind faith is the kind of faith we have when we simply believe what we've been told without really questioning it or considering these beliefs very much for ourselves. And now, as you all, I think, know quite well, this isn't the type of faith that's really encouraged by the Buddha. Many of you, I think, are familiar with the Kalama Sutta, and in this sutta we have the story of a group of people, the Kalamas, who had seen so many different teachers visiting and heard so many teachings and so many practices that they were just totally confused and they didn't know what to believe. And when the Buddha visited them, they asked him about this. And his response, you know, quoting one of the translations of the suttas, was, "Now Kalamas don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability or by thought, or even by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. But when you know for yourselves that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. And when you know for yourselves these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So we're encouraged not to simply rely on tradition or on authority even, but to really look and see for ourselves." Now, when you consider that we're coming from this sort of teaching, we typically really don't consider blind faith to have much of a role in our practice. And especially for most of us who have come to Buddhism from other religious traditions, we think of blind faith as something that we associate maybe with the faith of our childhood, something that we grew up believing because it was what our parents taught us, or our priests or pastors or rabbis taught us, or something that our community taught us. And now this is something that's really more in our past, something that we've left behind. And it really isn't a part of our current practice. And I think in some ways this probably really is true, because, you know, we all have come to this tradition and are exploring it for ourselves through our own experience. And yet at the same time, it's possible for a sort of blind faith to kind of creep in without our always realizing it, when we start to kind of proceed with our practice with the sort of on autopilot, you might say. And one way that blind faith can manifest is when we get into too much of a routine with our practice. You know, we sit, we come to Tuesday nights, we listen, but in a way we kind of feel like, you know, okay, we're checking it off on our to-do list the way we brush our teeth or do our sit-ups or something like that, you know. And maybe when we are here, we're only half here. And we have this kind of sense of, oh yeah, been there, done that, we've heard it all before. And it's really good to kind of notice when this sort of creeps in. It isn't so hard for this to happen. I know that I have certainly noticed this sometimes in myself. And when we see ourselves falling into this attitude, You know, it can be a good thing maybe to try something a little bit different, to break out of our routine. Maybe experiment with the style of practice that we don't usually do. Sometimes going on a retreat with a teacher that we haven't practiced with much can help us. Maybe just doing a little bit of exploring in a different tradition just to see what's going on there. Maybe involving ourselves more in some type of service with the Sangha, because there's nothing like something new and novel to wake up the mind and get it to paying attention and questioning. These can all be very good things to do. But yet, maybe even a better thing, if we're able to do it, is to really recognize what's happening and see, recognize and turn our attention to this very feeling of maybe boredom, routine, lack of engagement, and really notice that itself, and perhaps notice some of the thoughts and emotions that might be behind it. You know, sometimes this can come from an underlying feeling of doubt or fear, or perhaps disappointment in what we feel that the practice should have promised and hasn't, that we haven't really fully admitted to ourselves. And actually getting in touch with these kinds of feelings of disengagement can be a really difficult thing to do. I think probably harder than paying attention to feelings of aversion or feelings of strong wanting. They can be so elusive, but if we can do that, that can be a very, very helpful way to understanding this kind of phase that I think we all go through in our practice. Another area where blind faith can show up is when we find ourselves holding very strong and rigid views. For example, one way this can happen is that if rather than taking the precepts or other aspects of sila and moral conduct, instead of using them as trainings to help us understand what kind of behavior really fosters harmony and really helps to bring peace with ourselves and peace in our relation to others, we approach them in a very strict and dogmatic way and use them to judge ourselves, and find ourselves either virtuous or wanting, or to judge either other people as bad or good by how well we conform to these rules. And naturally, of course, it's really a good thing to have moral guidelines. We need moral guidelines, and there are certain kinds of behaviors that all of us definitely agree are harmful and really should be avoided. So it isn't so much these guidelines that is the problem, but rather an attitude that maybe puts too much emphasis on judgment and not enough emphasis on understanding. And it also certainly is true that when it comes to some of the more subtle situations that we get into, it's not always so easy to tell exactly what is right and exactly what is wrong. In the KM group that I go to, we've been reading a book by Ajahn Suchito on karma, and he has a really terrific paragraph in this book where he addresses this very question of right and wrong and rigid views. And he starts out by talking, you know, mentioning the type of person that sometimes they encounter at the monastery on retreats, who he describes as being very diligent in practice, but really difficult to work with in the kitchen because they insist on having everything done their way. And I think, you know, we maybe can relate to the experiences we sometimes have with this type of situation. And so, of course, this rigid behavior, you know, that's wrong, isn't it? And yet, he goes on to say, well, but actually, usually such a person is really motivated by the desire to make sure that everything goes smoothly and everybody gets fed on time in the best way possible. And that attitude is right, isn't it? Then he gives an example of a person, say that during a retreat, breaks the noble silence to speak briefly to some other retreatant. Now that's against the rules. That's wrong, isn't it? And yet, at the same time, maybe this person spoke because they noticed that this other person was, you know, really upset or having some kind of trouble and needed some encouragement. Now, isn't that right? Then he also gives an example of somebody that on the retreat is walking when everybody else is sitting or sitting when everybody is walking. Now, surely this is not right to, you know, not obey the schedule, disrupt everybody else's, you know, practice. And yet, at the same time, maybe this person is doing that because they really can feel, or maybe even have been advised by the teacher, that this is what they need right at this time to keep a balance in their practice. Which, of course, you know, that's right, isn't it? So you kind of get this idea that maybe it isn't always such a wise thing to rush to judgment so quickly. And, you know, even though maybe even more important than obeying the letter of the law, what we really need to do is to recognize and practice what is kind, what is helpful, and what really promotes harmony. Another example where blind faith might be operating is when we have a similarly kind of rigid view or strong attachment to certain practices or teachings or maybe a particular teacher with this attitude of, okay, this is the right way, everybody else is wrong. Now, naturally too, in this case, it's really good when we can recognize teachings and practices that resonate with us and follow those kinds of practices. And discernment is important too. You know, just as in the example of the Kalamas, if we notice certain practices or teachings that don't really ring true with us or don't seem quite right and tend to increase rather than lessen disharmony and suffering, then of course we should not follow them. But it's also really important to understand that there's more than one way to express the truth of the Dharma, and that there are a whole variety of practices and skillful means that we can use for realizing the Dharma. And the Buddha himself gave a whole different range of teachings, hoping to be able to provide what would be most helpful for the particular people that are listening to him. And we often see this for ourselves in our own practice, how we can be drawn to certain styles and techniques of practice, while others don't really do so much for us. But they might be really helpful for other people. And we might also see sometimes that what doesn't seem so helpful at one point, maybe a few months or years down the road, will be the thing that we really rely on to get us through a difficult patch. So it's really good to keep an open mind and not be solidified in our views. One of the big pitfalls that we get into when we become too fixed in our views too is that we really stop questioning. We stop investigating. We stop looking, and we assume that we already know how everything is, when in truth we most likely don't, and especially in truth we most likely don't when we're most convinced that we do know. So, you know, if we get too stuck in these ideas that we have about things, we don't see what's actually there. So it's good to be aware of this pitfall of being too attached to views. Another example of blindness is when we talk, you know, very knowledgeably and very glibly about certain Buddhist concepts such as non-self or emptiness, things like that, without really having a very clear understanding of what these things really mean. Now, this might be the situation of somebody that has done a lot of reading and has done a lot of study, and they have a lot of intellectual understanding of the philosophy of Buddhism, but not so much real experience of practice. And sometimes we can kind of fall into this tendency because we feel like we should understand, and everybody else around us understands. And so it's really very tempting to give the impression that we do understand, because, you know, a lot of us, we know the words that we should say, we know how to talk the talk, and so, you know, we kind of maybe say more than we really know. And sometimes, too, we may even believe that we understand more than we really do because we have some idea about the thing or we've heard about the thing. And yet, if we look deeply, we see that it isn't really quite true. You know, it was very interesting last week when we did the exercise with the dyads. I think many of you were here for that. And as I was preparing and thinking about this talk, I realized that during that time, I noticed a really nice example of really truly understanding the difference between knowing about something and deeply understanding it for ourselves. And for those of you who weren't there last week, as part of the dyad exercise, we had a repeating question: what cannot die in this moment? And I think, as those of you who were there know, when we're in this room, we're kind of in these little mini groups, and everybody around us is in these mini groups, and everybody's repeating the question, and everybody is answering the question. All through the room, you notice these voices just reverberating with the questions and the answers, and the questions and the answers. And even while we ourselves are asking and answering, it's really hard not to notice all of this that's going on around us. And so, you know, I did too. And one of the things that really struck me was how often I heard responses to this question of what cannot die in this moment, of something kind of expressing something like, well, you know, I can say that this is the unconditioned, or the silence, or awareness, or presence, and yet, really, I'm not sure if I truly, truly, deeply know exactly what this means for myself from my own experience. Or, you know, I can say these things and I have a sense of them, but I don't think I've truly experienced it yet directly for myself. And, you know, to say this kind of thing really demonstrates a lot of honesty and a lot of humility. And I think that's very, very important in practice. And it's more important than trying to appear as if one knows. So I think it's something quite touching, really, I felt, was the honesty that was on display here. So in any case, we have blind faith, something we usually don't associate with our practice, that we can notice and be aware of in case it does sort of creep in these various ways. A second kind of faith that's often mentioned is bright faith. And bright faith is the kind of faith we have when we feel very inspired, maybe by a particular teacher, a book we've read, a Dharma talk we've heard. Sometimes it can even be inspiration from an experience that we ourselves have had in practice that we feel seems really, really wonderful, but that we don't really understand well enough yet to have the wisdom or experience to, you know, interpret wisely. And with bright faith, we get very excited about the possibilities of the Dharma and what it may hold for us and what is to come. Bright faith is something that's often associated with the early stages of practice, and, you know, it's sort of a falling in love phase, you might say, when we're just beginning and everything about meditation seems really new and really wonderful. And in a lot of ways, bright faith is really a very, very good thing, because it can be what really provides us with that impetus and that inspiration that really gets us going and gets us to pursue the path. But it also clearly does have its limitations, and maybe one of the biggest limitations of bright faith is how much it really is focused on the future and wrapped up in our visions and dreams of where our practice will take us and of the things that we might experience and who we will be maybe when we have, you know, a deeper sense of spirituality, you know, all of these kinds of dreams of the future. I know that when I was just starting out in the early stages of my practice, I went on a few retreats and had some, you know, really good experiences, you know, of what we might call the magic of mindfulness. And so, you know, I got this idea that, you know, oh, I understand what it's all about. You go on retreat, you get into this really special atmosphere, you sit and you walk and you kind of get into this blissful zone and you just stay there. And that's what practice is all about. Well, needless to say, it wasn't long before I found that it really doesn't work that way. So, you know, that's the trouble with bright faith, is that unless we really get that faith more grounded in reality and actual experience, as soon as things don't go quite the way we imagine that they ought to be, we can lose our faith. And just the same way as when we're in a romantic relationship, kind of in these early stages where everything is really based on our fantasies about this other person, we can very quickly fall out of love as soon as some difficulty arises or we see some flaw. So bright faith can really be a great thing to inspire us and help get us in motion, but at some point we need to leave behind these fantasies of what we might experience and really turn our attention to the way things really are and what actually is happening in our mind and bodies. And this brings us to verified faith, which we might think of as kind of the gold standard of faith. And this is the faith that we have because we actually have sat down and done the work and done the practice, looked deeply at our minds and bodies and their workings, and have really seen for ourselves, yes, this truly is the way it is, and this really is true. Now, early in our practice, an example of verified faith might be simply trying meditation and appreciating the sense of relaxation that we feel and well-being we experience just from sitting quietly and attending to the breath. Or maybe going home from the very first day long that we attend and noticing a deep sense of calm in ourselves that we have never really felt before, and, you know, kind of thinking, you know, maybe there really is something to this meditation stuff after all. Or it could come as we begin to attend to our daily activities with more attention and more presence, and let our attention be more fully with the movements of our bodies, with the seeing and the hearing and tasting. We might be struck with the real sense of aliveness and freshness that these experiences have, and how much more vivid they are when we see them more directly than when we see them through this veil of our thoughts and with only a fraction of our real attention. Or an instance of verified faith might come when, after observing the really amazing and ever-changing play of thoughts and emotions in the mind, that the story that we've told ourselves for years and years about how we're a fearful person or an angry person or whatever sort of person really isn't true, and these emotions we've identified with so strongly really aren't there all the time, and like any other emotions. They come, they're there for a while, and then they go. Or it might be a realization of how much we're contributing to our own suffering with the stories that we tell ourselves of blame and resistance and unfairness, when really the way that true healing can come is by turning not to all of this stuff around what's happening, but to the pain itself and meeting that with compassion. And finally, often happening as a culmination of experiencing what we might consider these smaller or more personal revelations, there are those very deep insights into dukkha, anicca, and anatta, into suffering, impermanence, and non-self that we have, the kinds of deep insights that where we really do see for ourselves that what the Buddha said in his sermon on the Four Noble Truths actually is really true. Now, before I go any farther, though, I really want to acknowledge the fact that the path from bright faith to verified faith isn't always an easy one. In the poem that I read earlier in the talk, this can be, it's an in-between time, and it really can be kind of a wintry and difficult time, a tough place in practice. If we find ourselves in that spot where we're looking and we're struggling, we're wanting so much to understand, to realize something, and it just isn't happening, this isn't very easy to be there, you know. And in those times when we're so confused and we just don't see the verification of our faith or the fruits of our efforts, this is a place where something we can really learn to have faith in and to have value, and to value is the Sangha. At these kind of times, the encouragement of a teacher or a mentor or a friend who maybe is just a little bit farther along in our practice than we are can really be invaluable. You know, a person that can just reassure us in this struggle that, you know, we aren't crazy or we're not doing something wrong, that can tell us that what we're experiencing is normal and it's part of the process, that can reassure us that they've been there too and they've gotten through it. And this can really help so much. As I think that all of us can testify, this isn't something that we can do all alone. And it really takes some support and some guidance and some encouragement. And I think the difficult places are some of the places where we really learn and get some verified faith in the value of Sangha and community. Now, in any case, we do finally move through those difficult places, move through the darker times and the brighter times of our practice, or as I've heard them called sometimes, the dukkha or suffering phases of practice and the sukha or peace and happiness phases of practice. We do experience these instances of verified faith, the small ones and the major ones, and they gradually contribute to a very deep sense of the truth of the Dharma, the value of the path, and the fact that this practice that we've undertaken really does work and really does lessen our suffering. And this brings us to a fourth type of faith, which Sharon Salzberg refers to in her really beautiful book on faith that I think probably many of you have read, as abiding faith. And to me, this type of faith is the one that most fully fits the Pali word for faith, or sada, which I've heard defined in English as to place one's heart upon. And with abiding faith, this is the level of faith where we really do place our heart on the Dhamma and know for ourselves that this is our path. And even though there may still be these areas of confusion, things we don't understand, there's still this kind of sense that, you know, that's okay. It really is okay. And we have this feeling that in spite of, you know, things not always going quite so smoothly, in spite of our imperfections and our struggles, there really is a process for good that has begun within us, and it's going to continue, and it's going to bear fruit, even if we don't always understand the way that it's working. And that really is a wonderful thing to be able to have in our practice. There's a quotation that I heard in a talk. I think it might have been one of Rodney's or it might have been a different teacher. I don't really remember quite where I heard it. But it's attributed to the Buddhist teacher Munindra, who I think many of you have heard of and was a guiding teacher for several of the very well-known teachers in our tradition, including Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and also Kamala Masters. And this quote was, "If you sit and know you are sitting, all of the Dhamma unfolds before you." And I think the confidence that this is true is really a part of abiding faith. You know, this confidence that if we show up for our practice, what we need to know is going to be revealed to us in that practice. And it might not happen to our on our own time schedule, but it will happen as we're ready through a natural process of an unfolding. Another saying of Munindra that I've often heard from Kamala Masters is, "When the fruit is ripe, it will fall from the tree." And this kind of expresses sort of a similar sort of thing, you know, this sense that our progress has a natural unfolding and there will be fruition. But maybe not on our own timetable. This saying kind of reminds myself of the way I felt about this apple tree, old apple tree I have in my yard. And this past summer, for the first time since I've been at this house, it had all kinds of fruit. Before this, it really never bore fruit, but it had all kinds of fruit. And so I was like, oh boy, there's going to be all these apples. And I kept waiting. When are they going to be ripe? When are they going to be ripe? When are they going to be ripe? You know, they weren't ripe. They weren't ripe. They weren't ripe. And, you know, it's sort of this, the abiding faith sort of saves us from all of this questioning. When are we going to be ripe? When are we going to be ripe? We trust that ripening is going to happen, and in its own time. In spite of, you know, the fact that it doesn't seem to be happening when we think it should. And finally, now I would like to talk about something that maybe is even more basic than the trust that we have in the process of awakening or our trust in where the Dharma may take us. And that's the faith that we have in the very practice itself, in the very act of practicing. And, you know, by this I mean our faith in the value of just sitting and knowing we are sitting, walking, knowing we are walking. Not so much because we're thinking about the wisdom that we will get by doing these actions, but simply we really value being present just for itself. And this is something in his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi is talking about when he talks about sitting with no gaining idea. You know, this sense that we just sit because of the value of sitting. And whatever happens to be going on and unfolding in that moment. Because we really value and we know that it's worth it to be here for our lives. And, you know, I think more than anything else, this sense that it is worth it to be here is what really keeps us going. You know, wherever we feel like we might be on the path, whatever we feel might be happening or not happening, you know, whatever we like or don't like, whatever we think we're getting out of it or not getting out of it. At some point, beyond all of that stuff, eventually it really comes down to the very, very basics. Here is the body sitting. Here is the body breathing. Here are thoughts arising and passing, and our faith just in that, I think, really is what perhaps is the most important kind of faith of all. Some of you might know Eugene Cash, who teaches at Spirit Rock and in San Francisco. And he was, when I did the DPP program, he was one of our teachers in that program. And if you've sat at Spirit Rock, perhaps you have know of him. And he was in a serious bicycle accident, I think maybe it's maybe a couple years ago now, a little while ago, not too long ago. And it was really quite a serious thing, and there was even, you know, some fear that he might not make it through. But very thankfully, he's fully recovered, and he's back to his normal activities now. And just this last fall, I was lucky enough to go to a retreat at Cloud Mountain that, you know, quite to my surprise, he also was sitting this retreat and was in one of the small discussion groups that I was part of. And in this group, he talked a little bit about his accident and about how that experience really deepened his appreciation for the Dharma and his appreciation, you know, really just for life itself. And one of the things he said was that if he had to describe this sense that he had in just two words, they would be good and wow. And I was like, you know, that really kind of struck a chord with me, you know. The goodness and wonder of life and the goodness of wonder of this practice that really connects us so much more fully to the experience of living. And I think, you know, this is something all of us can probably relate to, because it is that kind of sense of good and wow that kind of got us started on this path, I think, often, and what keeps us going. That sense that brought us to this room tonight, that keeps us returning week after week. And where do we really connect more deeply with this good and the wow than really in the present moment? When we're just sitting, when we're just walking, with no other aim but to be fully present for these experiences. We sit, we know we are sitting. Here are the sensations of the body. Here's the movement of the mind. Just this. Just this. And as we do this and are fully there, what is truly miraculous, just this, is enough. It really is enough. And what can I say about that? But good and wow. So let's sit for a few minutes. Thank you all so much for coming tonight and listening to the Dhamma. And now we have some time for any questions or comments that you might have. So feel free to bring them forth. Oh, yes.
First, I really appreciated the talk and the progression. Really, it seemed like time is away. But I needed to hear and I was right with you until when you said that possibly the most important thing is just the sitting, being able to make the body.
Oh, well, I think there are many ways to say that's the most important part. I can sort of see for myself that it is very important, because at some point we always, but I should probably repeat the question to make sure that everybody can hear the question. The question was how to proceed when one doesn't really feel a sense of relaxation or good or wow in sitting or walking. And I think one thing that I'm trying to convey with that is just the sense of what we feel when we're in the present. Which may not necessarily for everybody be in the actual physical sense of being right on the cushion. It might be something that you experience more fully walking in nature with all of your senses really attuned to what's happening. Or in communion with others when you really feel a deep sense of connection. But I think the most important thing is that it's what's happening, not our ideas of what may happen, but which is what we find when we're really tuned in to the present moment. So hopefully that helps a bit. And I think, too, there's always a bit of a tension between the importance of the growing wisdom and understanding we feel in our practice and the truth of the present. You know, both of them play a big role, so both are important. Yes? Well, thank you too. I'm glad that resonated with you. The comment was that it was very helpful to kind of get a sense of, you know, on one hand we can sit and always be sort of, you know, struggling with what's happening, and yet maybe a good thing to do is to just, if we can drop that sense of struggling and just rest in what actually is happening, in the just this. And maybe that can be a key to truly experiencing some of the freedom that we can have in the Dhamma. Yeah, the comment was about how scary it can sometimes be, even if it's just on an unconscious level, to release that sense of doing and fixing. And I think that is so true, very, very true. I mean, when we release that, we're really releasing a lot of our sense of who we are. I mean, we define ourselves by being able to do and being able to fix, and that doing and fixing is part of that sense we have of, you know, I'm here doing this. This is, you know, I am here. My actions are there, this duality. And to let go of that is kind of to let go of ourselves and step into that region of non-self, which really can be quite scary, because it can be very kind of unfamiliar and a little bit threatening when we're not quite used to it. So that's very true, I agree. Then something sometimes we end up doing very gradually as we begin to feel that it actually is safe. Well, if there isn't anything else, we do have some announcements this evening.